JT, you were saying.
I was scrolling through Twitter and somebody said the longer this Africa stuff escalates, the closer we get to Biden having to correctly pronounce Niger on live TV. I can't wait.
It's gonna be a, what's called a flashbulb memory. Yeah. Right? It's gonna remind him of segregationist days, and immediately he's just gonna say,
with the hard R and everything. Yeah.
You're gonna see like lasers shoot out of his eyes.
Yeah, he's gonna yell it like he yelled soda.
Oh my god.
Obama
Beep soda. Oh my god. Dude, I sometimes say this shit at work. Sometimes I'm walking between like where the nurses are to go to my computer. I pick up a patient, like, you know, paper yeah. thing. And I'm like, I don't say it out loud, but it goes through my head. I'm like, I need to make sure people don't know I'm this fucking stupid.
I do the same. Like, I think I had a call like 3-4 days ago, and somebody was making a very bad presentation. I didn't even notice that I wasn't muted, and because JT fucking shoved this thing in my head every time I see something relatively cringe or relatively like explosive, I always say, "Oh my god!" And I wasn't actually muted, but thankfully there was like 70, 80 people in the call, and nobody noticed it was me. But
oh god.
I mean, I don't know about you. Like, is it cringe? Is it officially cringe to say lol, like, in real life, in physical life?
Nah.
Because it used to be extremely cringe.
We've passed through so many layers of irony that no one can even tell anymore.
Lol.
So, I think you're safe. I mean, the way you did it just then was cringe, yes.
Yeah, but about your, oh my god, I imagined you in an actual boardroom, not a Zoom meeting.
I used to be in fucking boardrooms, but now Zoom meetings are basically boardrooms. You see, they took away the last thing mm-hmm. that, you know, corporate high-end people had going for them to make themselves, like, feel better and superior to everyone else, which is, you know, the fancy sky rises and so on. Now they don't even have that. Like, they're in their pajamas at home just like everybody else. Though, you know, the great... I heard a quote by Elon Musk. He literally calls now the people that want to work from home, which, good for you, man. Fuck yeah. The laptop class. He calls them the laptop class, which doesn't...
Oh, my lord. Yeah. Please. Isn't he peddling like white genocide bullshit in South Africa?
Yeah,
of course. Oh, have you seen? You must have heard the song. The
oh, slaps. Yeah.
Kill the bull. Please insert it here, please.
Shoot to kill. Hamaza. Kill the poor. The farmer. Kill the poor. The farmer. Brr, pa.
Do you know how many times I've listened to it? Fuck, I'm going to open up to listen to it later.
Yeah, it's a bop.
Yeah. Oh,
but it's white genocide, boys. It's not funny, you know? Both of you have a bit of white in you. Yeah?
Do I have? Actually, no, I told you about this. A family member of mine did one of those genetic tests, and he came back with an eclectic mix to rival. I don't know how many people have nutted in my, like, people of different shades have nutted in my timeline. But yeah, dude, it came back like... people from the subcontinent, Greek and Italian,
wow.
and also like
oh my god, Italian! Fucking kick him from the call right now, JT. Get this fucking thing away from me.
I didn't
Get
say
this
French.
Fucking thing. Oh lord,
I didn't say French. It's okay.
I'm walking over here. I love it. I love it.
I got look. The most important thing is I am a not insignificant. In fact, it's not. It's the second largest percentage after being Arab, Georgian. So I think I have a common ancestor with Stalin. Which makes me very warm inside.
Hell yeah.
That's where the liberal comes from. There is not a single Georgian that I know that is not a liberal. It is absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I know.
It's one of those ethnicities, like, that I'm kind of racist towards when it comes to this. I'm like, all of them are liberals. Like, I am. This is kind of, like, it's pretty racist, but I'm sorry. Like, I know 100 of them. I think that's a pretty decent fucking sample size, okay? Okay, now I'm literally sounding like a racist. I'm sorry. Please continue.
You know, there's a certain, like, type of Balkan person. I won't specify the nationality, mm-hmm. but they're very gung-ho NATO, pro-US. Mm-hmm. Oh, let's have a statue of Reagan.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's, Georgians kind of remind me of that. But of course, it's, I mean, like, post, quote-unquote, independence, quote-unquote, like, cringe. where a very narrow group of people are allowed into political power and to have opinions, blah, blah, blah. We're not good. This is the shit-talking segment. I'm not here to...
you don't need to, yeah, no disclaimers. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
Just let me be racist. So be racist. Let me just be racist, okay? Don't have to explain away my Yugopnik's opinions to the liberals in the walls. Mm. If anything else, not bigoted. Liberal, Yugopnik immediately bigoted. That's just my racial ideology that I will include in my new manifesto of what would you call this? Anti-liberal racist Marxism, like anti-liberal national Marxism. There you go. I love it. I love that. But the nation is just being anti-liberal. Like I will create a new nation that is completely based on being anti-liberal. Like that's gonna be the whole culture. Like the whole hymn, like the anthem is gonna be fuck liberals, fuck liberals. Like that's the whole thing.
Needs a little work. That anthem needs a little work, not gonna lie.
Hello and welcome back to the program. Today we have a very fun episode, I hope that you all agree. We're covering a episode of Korean history, particularly South Korean history, and possibly the longest reigning dictator of South Korea.
The Japanese have accepted our terms fully. That is the word we have just received from the White House in Washington, and I didn't expect to hear a celebration here in our newsroom in New York, but you can hear one going on behind me. We switched to London. I don't know what happened. I'm not even sure whether you heard the first words of Prime Minister Attlee or not. I couldn't hear anything in our speaker here with the confusion. Suddenly, we got the word from our private telephone wire from the White House in Washington. The Japanese have accepted fully the surrender terms of the United Nations. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War. It is not, of course, the official VJ Day, but the United Nations on land, on sea, on air, to the four corners of the earth and the seven seas are united and are victorious.
After the Japanese were defeated in World War II, the victorious people of Korea created their own nation, the People's Republic of Korea, as it was called. This republic had many communists in its ranks, and Kim Il-sung, the founder of the DPRK, was a recognized hero of the anti-Japanese resistance. As a result, he held lots of clout. The US was very swift to act. They completely dismantled all local worker and peasant organizations they found under their military control. They imprisoned or killed communists and illegally declared a different republic. Sham elections were held, and this action solidified the division between the two Koreas, starting a half century of dictatorial rule in the South.
200,000 persons in Seoul Stadium hear members of the opposition Democratic Party campaign for election. South Korea is going to the polls to choose a president and vice president. As this huge rally would suggest, voter interest runs high, though not to the benefit of the Democratic Party. A record turnout of almost 95% of the eligible voters gives an overwhelming fourth-term victory to President Syngman Rhee and his Liberal Party running mate Lee Ki-pung. Though Rhee is unopposed, his opponent having died last month in Washington, the one-sided outcome in the vice presidential contest points to clear-cut support for Rhee.
Just as a note before we get started into the details, this is mostly for fun. We reject great man theory. Things don't happen because one person wills them to be so. Likewise, although it's fun to psychoanalyze figures of history, it's mostly just a meme. There's no credible basis to it. So we're doing a little bit of both of these just for the narrative structure of it. But keep in mind that the reason that Korea developed along that particular path is because of certain geopolitical and material interests. And likewise, to pretend that somebody's upbringing is entirely the reason why he acted in such a way is reductive, to say the least. So keep that in mind before we go on. That being said, who are we discussing exactly? This man is named Park Chung-hee. I apologize to anybody who speaks Korean. I'm probably going to mispronounce many names.
This whole episode is a nightmare when it comes to this. Like, holy shit.
Exactly right. All right, so Park was a young Korean boy right as the Russian Revolution was fighting its civil war. He was born on the 14th of November 1917, just 1 week after the October Revolution, in Central Korea under Japanese occupation. Despite having a thoroughly based dad, let's say at least that much, who took part in peasant revolts against the land aristocracy in Korea, at least in the late 1800s, that revolt sadly failed. And as a result, his dad ended up taking to drinking and just wandering around communities as he was essentially expelled from his clan for having participated in these revolts. this kind of relegated Park's entire family into severe destitution. They were very, very poor. Despite this base history that he had, not being poor, but his dad taking part in peasant revolts, he grew up to be extremely cringe, as the kids say. I think there's one episode of his life. This is actually the most interesting one, because it's just so weird that so many biographers have decided to note this down. Park's mother was pregnant with him at the age of 43, which is fairly old for a pregnancy. She herself felt that she didn't have the energy for the pregnancy. The situation economically was very difficult. So she tried to abort the child. But of course, this is, early 20th century in rural Korea. What are you going to do to try to abort a child? So she tried the local remedies that they had at the time, which was drinking bowls of soy sauce and throwing herself off of high places.
Oh my God.
That's a direct quote. That didn't kill the kid somehow.
The kid was like, I really want to do genocide and take and work with the Americans. Sorry.
Exactly. Exactly.
Ain't no soy sauce killing me.
actually, you'd think America wasn't his ideal. Let me introduce you to possibly the greatest weeaboo to ever grace this earth.
Oh, Lord, even worse. How, like, what one would think, what's worse than wanting to be a Yank and then you fucking walk in with this thing?
Being French.
Yeah.
Oh, but also being a weeaboo. Oh, my God. Anyways, he grew up to be a fairly decent student, despite being very malnourished throughout his entire childhood. Despite this, he quickly developed a distaste for what he considered to be rural life and primitive countryside life. This is something that comes out very frequently in his life, particularly in his future. Apparently, it's said that he couldn't stand the sight of thatched roofs, which is interesting. I guess I get like not wanting to visit your family in the countryside, but goddamn, but he lived in it, so I guess that's different. Regardless, as I was telling you, he was a lifelong weeaboo, which is honestly his greatest crime. He admired Japan to a fault. He admired it to the point that he took a Japanese name, and that name was Takagi Maso. As using this name, and of course his admiration and bootlegging for the Japanese, he went on to enter into the Manchukuo army after he graduated. The Manchukuo army was the military of a puppet state established by Imperial Japan in Manchuria, which is in the northeastern part of China. This was a completely puppet government. It was made solely to fight the communist and nationalist Chinese forces and to try to give geopolitical legitimacy to Japanese claims of territory, I mean. His Japanese instructors that saw him in this army and also in whatever academies that he attended prior, they really liked him, and they went on to actually recommend him to fairly high-level institutions even in mainland Japan, specifically the Imperial Japanese Army Academy in Japan. He was one of very few Koreans allowed to do so. The saying kind of goes along that a Korean can never be Japanese, but they can understand what it means to be Japanese, which is very racist, but also, I don't know, it's like, maybe this is, again, me being very outside of this cultural context, but all these cultures that were raised in this, you know, Taoist, Buddhist, Confucian type of structure seem to have a fairly similar outlook. It's like, you know, the difference between Persian, Turkish, and Arab cultures. Like, yeah, there are differences, but there's like this, they still coalesce around one point, more or less. So for them to be so racist against each other, not against each other, specifically Japanese, to be so racist against Koreans, I don't know, it just always strikes me as very funny. But anyways, he attended this academy, he graduated, and then afterwards he was posted to a Japanese army regiment in Manchuria and served there until the surrender of Japan at the end of World War II. He enjoyed being a puppet his entire life. He flip-flopped a lot. It's very clear that whenever there was a opportune side to join, he would join it. I'll get into this in detail a little bit later, but his Japanese foray was the first episode in this. Immediately, once the Japanese were defeated, he switched sides and became an officer for the United States Army military government in South Korea.
From end to end of the Pacific, the work of liberation continues. The city of Seoul, capital of Korea, is occupied by American forces.
It's surprising that they allowed him to do this, but there was a certain admiration for his militaristic tendencies, let's put it lightly like that. And that kind of gave him a foot in the door to allow him to enter into this sphere. So he immediately switched the Japanese masters for American masters. The U.S. established the dictatorship of, or a dictatorship in South Korea under the leadership of Syngman Rhee, a short time after World War II. And this government was so paranoid about communists, and rightfully so, because there are plenty around, that Park himself was arrested in 1948 on charges that he led a communist cell.
Wow.
He was sentenced to death by a military court and only released after several high-ranking Korean military officers intervened on his behalf, of course. Apparently, and this is where the flip-flopping comes in, Park was a member of the Workers' Party of South Korea, but was never active in the organization. The party itself was and affiliated communist groups were insanely popular in Korea at this time. They had over 360,000 members and even an armed wing that was active in the countryside in 1947 and onwards. Of course, this is why they were relentlessly persecuted and outlawed by U.S. authorities, and that's why that motion is unsurprising. But also, likewise, it makes sense why such an opportunist as Park was habitually throughout his entire life. This makes sense why he would jump on this communist bandwagon, despite later on leaving it when it became convenient for him. The Workers' Party of South Korea is an interesting story in and of itself. We won't delve too deeply into it, but the party itself was opposed to the formation of a South Korean state. And of course, this put it in the crosshairs, what the fuck is it called?
Crosshairs, yeah, you're right.
The crosshairs of the United States. In 1948, the party instigated general strikes in opposition to the plans to create a separate South Korean nation. And on the 3rd of April of 1948, the party led a popular uprising on an island called the Jeju Island. Of course, this was against the unilateral declaration of the foundation of South Korea, so-called Republic of Korea. The U.S. immediately, with their South Korean allies, brutally suppressed the revolt. They killed thousands of people on the island. It's now known as the Jeju Massacre. And this is one of the first and one of many massacres to take place on what is now South Korea. This is one domino that kind of began a process of massacres that killed up to or possibly even more than 200,000 people for being quote-unquote suspected communists. Jeez. A lot of these people, by the way, because many of the communists who were active in clandestine work and organizational work knew how to kind of get out of suspicion or went into the countryside and so on. So what you ended up having is regular peasants that usually didn't have anything to do with the communist movement being rounded up and killed and dumped in unmarked graves. Mm. And that is up to or over 200,000 people, which is a number that's unfathomable to even imagine. Park himself returned to the army, the South Korean army that was basically established by the United States government and military apparatus in Korea. He returned to this army after not being executed, and he fought in the Korean War against the DPRK, or so-called North Korea, to prove his loyalty to Syngman Rhee and the new like Comprador-led ruling class within Korea, and of course his American masters.
Close on the heels of discussions of Far East strategy by Generals MacArthur and Bradley comes news that communist troops have invaded southern Korea. In swift response, President Truman has ordered United States Sea and Air Forces to give cover and support to the South Korean troops of President Syngman Rhee, who is here being greeted by General MacArthur in Tokyo. United States action is explained as implementing the Security Council's resolution.
He was sent to the U.S. to train afterwards, of course, because, again, they noticed certain traits in him that they liked. He made some very important contacts that served him well later on as he progressed through his career. He steadily rose through the ranks in a fairly short amount of time, by the way, around 10 years, which is not a long time for military careers, for sure. He rose through the ranks in Korea so quickly that by 1960, he was one of the most powerful and influential figures in the military and the country. In April of 1960, Syngman Rhee, who was the U.S.-backed dictator, he was forced out of office and into exile, of dying later in Hawaii at the age of like 92. He didn't see. he got his nice little American U.S. aid pension and everything. Mm. But he was pushed into exile following the 19th April movement, which was a student-led left-wing uprising. Which, by the way, no source likes to admit, unsurprisingly. Every single like student and worker movement in South Korea had a heavy presence of left-wing activists and communists. And they always want to try to brush that bit out of history, which is very funny. Because you see them, and they're waving red flags, and they're wearing certain slogans that are very unmistakably, you know, left-wing, far left. But, you know, they want to just be like, oh, no, they're pro-democracy, you know, because they try to reorientate after South Korea's shift towards whatever you want to consider its current political setup to be. Regardless, this 19th April movement was successful, and a new democratic government took office in August of 1960.
Seoul, capital of Southern Korea. Riots on the scale of revolution. More was to follow, but it already looked like the end of the road for President Syngman Rhee. In earlier rioting, police killed 130 people, wounded close on 1,000. That only incensed the population. By now, 30,000 risked battle with the police. Not even a tyrant like Rhee could go on ruling in face of this. This time, the police were once again too much for the people, but later, when 500,000 made a mass revolt, President Rhee said he'd resign and agreed to hold the election again. It seemed like victory for justice in South Korea.
They set up revolutionary tribunals to try people who were, you know, part of the dictatorship and all the rest. But Park saw his opportunity and he jumped into action, taking advantage of the political turmoil, of course, unsurprisingly, with U.S. aid and help. In the May of 1961, he launched a coup, which, through his like military fetishistic tendencies that existed throughout his whole life, he tried to kind of launch Korea into, or Korean society, into this highly regimented and almost like militaristic setup.
In first pictures from Seoul following the pre-dawn military coup that overthrew the South Korean government, troops guard public buildings in the early hours of martial law proclaimed by the army junta that took over the country.
One of his first acts upon coming into power was a campaign of ordering basically people into regiments to go out into the streets and to quote-unquote clean them up by arresting and putting the homeless and other people down their luck to work, of course, in so-called welfare centers, which, by the way, were essentially forced labor where they got basically treated very badly, beaten, many of them were even raped, and of course, not paid for anything. I think that's the least of their worries at that point. This is a pattern that will be frequently repeated during his rule. This idea of quote unquote national cleanliness, not in the like genetic way or something, but in the way that how the country should be viewed. Again, this is where that thatched roof nonsense comes into play. One of his second, or possibly the second measure that he took, was he started up something called the Korean Central Intelligence Agency, not a very creative name, which was made in order to prevent any counter coups, to suppress potential enemies, and particularly to suppress communists that were still very, very, very popular. They were given investigative powers, but also, much more importantly, they were given the authority to arrest and detain anyone for any reason for as long as they would like. But they, of course, used this privilege, let's call it that, particularly against those with so-called anti-government sentiments. So much like Batista's thugs in Cuba, they were glorified torturers, and this wasn't lost on the international community. He saw the writing on the wall here, and through some diplomatic pressure, let's say that much, particularly by the United States, who didn't tell him to stop being a dictator. They just told him to try to make his government look more legitimate, which is, by the way, very... if there's a more American fucking concept... Park agreed to trying to legitimize his government by quote-unquote transitioning to civilian rule. Basically in 1963, he ran as a candidate for a party called the Democratic Republican Party.
Nice.
Of course, all in the most creative names. And he was elected president, unsurprisingly. This party ran on a corporatist, conservative, and anti-communist line. So if you want to call it anything, you can consider it a fascism with Korean characteristics, I guess.
South Korea holds its first political election since the military junta took over the government 2 years ago. If the turnout was enthusiastic, the government was not. It took prodding by the United States, whose aid supports the country, to have it called. Former President Yun Po-sun is the principal losing candidate. After the election, he flees to the hills, fearing reprisals. Winner by a surprisingly narrow margin is General Chun Hee Park, who headed the junta. Had two minor candidates surrendered their votes to Yun, he would have won. Despite charges of fraud, this is a remarkably clean election. Whether its results will liberalize the government or continue a one-man rule, only Park can say.
The legitimacy of this election is very questionable, but I find it incredibly telling that various American government sources, the Wilson Center, the official CIA website, all these places, which, by the way, are technically considered legitimate sources in academia for this stuff, they are very interested in pushing there's the nice fascist was getting elected. Oh, fucking line. It's very pathetic and mask off, but it's genuinely... Like, and this is just a small side tangent. I've never seen so much defense being run for a fascist government in my life, particularly by American sources. Usually they're a bit more, you know, hands off with this thing. It's very mild. But goddamn, how they try to be like, oh, no, he was a complicated figure. Mm-hmm. But yeah, anyways, after so-called transitioning to civilian rule, he used the Soviet Union and its five-year plans as a model. He didn't really like the market-oriented policies as much. And he wanted to try to introduce planning, but on a corporatist basis. So this is a very typical, like, fascist agenda thing. And even in liberal democracies, in large conglomerates, this is done. Park launched his first five-year plan in 1962. He shifted the Korean economy to export-oriented industrialization focus, and the entire nation was mobilized for the corporatist sector to reap the benefits of this mobilization. The second five-year plan was in 1967, and Park helped found several state-owned plants and factories to provide cheap steel, labor, and other resources for the various corporate conglomerates within South Korea that are popping up. Park's government rewarded these family conglomerates that met targets within the five-year plans with loans with easy terms of repayment. They got tax cuts. They got easy licensing for whatever they needed. They got subsidies. Many household names that currently exist basically started out through Park's preferential treatment through mobilizing regular Korean people. LG, Samsung, Hyundai, these are all examples of these fascist-era businesses built on the exploitation of Korean people. Another point which I find a little bit telling, I guess, is Park was very interested in establishing good relations with West Germany, not East Germany, of course, specifically West Germany, because he knew where to get his... All right. He had what other people refer to as an affinity for Germany, which is very interesting because he didn't even want to establish relations with East Germany. Mm. He also noted personally.
Sorry for interrupting, but that's so funny because in the Balkans, sometimes we like to joke around, but people tend to refer to South Korea as Asia's Germany.
Yeah. And I'll tell you why. Park himself was like, he admired the strong leaders of Germany, which include, who do you think they include? they include Bismarck, which, okay, kind of, all right, whatever, and Hitler. So there you go. He also wanted to establish relations with, he eventually managed to, and very much like the Shah of Iran. Basically, he liked collecting whichever reactionary would shake his hand. Very, very telling that this fascist would go to the fascist of Iran and West Germany, specifically West Germany, to shake hands with. By the way, oh, but West Germany was a democracy. Yeah, look into it. All right, please. We need to do an episode on this properly, but... Mm. The West German, like, political establishment was riddled with Nazis, like, across top to bottom, even high level, you know, right? And I'm not going to get into it. But yeah, so unsurprisingly, workers took the brunt of this development. Like, for example, people were sent as, like, guest workers into West Germany and had their wages garnished by the South Korean government and then basically funneled into the development of the conglomerates, the corporate conglomerates. The workers within Korea as well didn't have it much better. The government did not recognize a minimum wage, so they could be paid basically nothing. There was no paid leave, and in some instances, there was no leave at all. There was no off time. There was imposed, quote-unquote, free work periods, where basically you'd have to come in and forcibly work and not be paid for it. There was basically a common notion of 12-hour days or work days being the minimum that you have to do. Trade unions and any sort of industrial action were completely prohibited and even severely punished. Essentially, the boot was there and you had to like it. It wasn't a fun time for Korean workers.
I mean, couldn't one say that they basically invented at that point, not invented, but let's say modernized the notion of the sweatshop? The way it works today, both outsourcing, like factory level outsourcing, not so-called, you know, intellectual / skilled labor outsourcing, but factory outsourcing and classic, you know, sweatshop type of work.
No, yeah, you're completely correct. Not only this, but the toxicity of modern workplace culture within South Korea is a direct descendant of this nonsense. And that's why South Korea has one of, if not the highest, suicide rates in the world. But something way worse was coming down the pike for everyday South Koreans, which was the Vietnam War. Yugopnik, could you please enter us into this fantastic episode of history?
GI, your government has abandoned you. They have ordered you to die, GI. Do not trust them. Defect, GI. It is a very good idea to leave a sinking ship. They lie to you, D.I. You know you cannot win this war. Your rich leaders grow richer while you die in the swamp, D.I.
So, ladies and gentlemen and NBs, once upon a time in the dark and twisted world of the Cold War, we find ourselves knee-deep in the Vietnam War. Enter the South Korean government under the iron-fisted rule of Park, who decided to throw his hat into the ring. From 1964 to 1973, South Korea sent a staggering 350,000 troops to Vietnam, becoming the second largest foreign force there after the almighty US of A. But why on earth did they do it? Well, General Che, the mastermind behind this madness, wanted to show off South Korea's military prowess and cozy up to their big brother, Uncle Sam. You see, the willy South Korean leaders thought that by joining the war, they could squeeze more military presence from the U.S., and in return, get a whole bunch of greenbacks to fuel their industry dreams. Who cares if they were dirt poor and sending their sons to a war that has absolutely nothing to do with them? Money talks, my loves. So, off they went with a mixed bag of combatants and non-combatants. They even sent around 100,000 civilian workers to Vietnam for vacation. Yeah, vacation. In the beginning, they tried to play nice. Engineers, medical teams, and even the Navy showed up to help build stuff and provide medical care to everyone. Classic, you know, winning hearts and minds campaign. But as time went on, the requirements for the Koreans by the Americans went up. So the gloves went off and it was time for them to get their good old hands dirty. Combat forces unleashed in the Tuy Hoa Valley, for example, saw impressive success. But the Koreans had a knack for withdrawing to the coast, and it's not like they were alone in their passivity. Other armies were also not thrilled about fighting tooth and nail after the Tet Offensive, especially because the states were slowly starting to talk about, you know, maybe ending this war. Nobody wants to die right at the end. But it wasn't all fun and games. Alongside their combat prowess, the South Korean forces were also busy with a very good side gig. War crimes, massacres, civilian casualties, and a sprinkle of brutality became part of their repertoire. They even gave the My Lai massacre a run for its money with their own fucked up variations. The Korean Ministry of Defense, of course, denies all such allegations, painting themselves as innocent angels. The litany of horrors is bone-chilling. Massacres in places I will not try to pronounce out of respect weigh heavily on their tarnished reputation. Refugee accounts and chilling reports in the New York Times reveal the scale of horror unleashed by South Korean forces. Mass killings and deliberate policies to slaughter civilians, all executed with chilling precision. Thousands of elderly women and children fell victim to their ruthless tactics. And did the U.S. leadership discourage these heinous acts? Most say no. They merely tolerated them, turning a blind eye to the horrors unleashed. The Associated Press and Reuters tried to shed light on the matter, but their efforts were thwarted. The Vietnamese victims' claims were hard to independently confirm, and the South Korean Defense Ministry remained tightly lipped. A massacre in the Bin An commune, where 1,200 innocent lives were taken, for example, was quickly hushed up. And yet, the grim revelations keep coming. As Korean forces marched through Vietnam, villages were reduced to rubble, and innocent lives paid the price for their military agendas. While some atrocities were addressed, like the revocation of an award for General Seo, the wounds still run very, very deep, and punishment remains elusive for many of the perpetrators. Within South Korea, shock and dismay rippled through society when these grim truths were first unveiled in the 1990s. As the country struggled with its own dark past, civic groups pushed for acknowledgement and accountability. Debates raged and calls for a Korean inquiry echoed, seeking truth and reconciliation for the bloodstained legacy of the Vietnam War. But let's get back to the geopolitical imperial chessboard. We don't want to talk about the little people too much. You might start to actually care, and we wouldn't want that now, would we? Okay, so as the war waged on, South Korea reaped some benefits. The U.S. paid for their troops' expenses, handed out military aid like candy, and even dished out economic goodies. A little something for their industrialization efforts and the development of those massive conglomerates we all know and love that Hakim previously mentioned. But wait, there's more. The War Alliance stabilized Park's regime, allowing him to flex his muscles, lock up opponents, and extend his rules like a boss. All this economic success kept communism at bay and bolstered Park's hold on power. So-called democracy, who needs that when our guy, you know, in brackets, the fucking meme, is in power? And what about those children conceived through wartime affairs and rape? The infamous Lai Dai Han, a touchy subject for both countries, swept under the rug like a dirty little secret. The Vietnamese government keeps your lips sealed and the Korean government pretends it never happened. In the end, the Vietnam War proved to be a dark, twisted roller coaster of power plays, economic gains, and bloodshed. South Korea got its moment in the spotlight, leaving behind a trail of blood and unresolved issues. But hey, isn't that just how the world of imperial wars works, my friends? In memory of the countless victims, a statue stands on Jeju Island, a grim testament to the horrors endured during the Vietnam War. Yet the scars run deep, and the ghosts of the past continue to haunt both South Korea and Vietnam, refusing to rest in peace.
D.I., your helicopters fall from the sky like broken birds.
Unsurprisingly, the South Korean economy flourished as a result of this very, very lovely war, as it was described by the American ruling establishment of the time. South Korea received tens of billions of dollars in grants, in loans, subsidies, technology transfers, and of course preferential economic treatment in international trade, from the United States particularly. This funded their industrialization efforts, and South Korea's largest conglomerates got lucrative business contracts awarded to them specifically by the U.S. military, of all things. Because of this, Park was eager to send South Korean troops into Vietnam, by the way, many of which were sent against their will in the tens of thousands of people, which is a terrifying thought, but what can you do? Park himself vigorously campaigned to extend the war. In fact, he significantly despised the more, not pacifist tone, but the reducing enthusiasm for the Vietnam War by the U.S. ruling establishment, and tried to use whatever contacts that he had himself to keep the war going. At around this time, Kim Il-sung, the leader of the DPRK, was hoping to improve relations between the two Koreas. He secretly sent Hwang Tae-song, a former friend of Park from childhood even, and he was, of course, this man was a vice minister of trade in the North. He sent him to South Korea to secretly meet and try to arrange some sort of reconciliation efforts. Park recognized his old friend and immediately executed him as a spy, mostly to prove to the Americans that he's not friendly with any communists.
Jesus.
Yes. There's some fucked up things that happened. This guy's like, oh, just wait for it. The Americans, unsurprisingly, had to give their approval and say for everything. And that they continuously warned of a communist insurgency in the country, in South Korea, because of course, the popularity of the communists. In a way, they insisted that Park should not violate the armistice in the fall of the Korean War because they thought that South Korea would lose that conflict because of the support of regular South Koreans for the communists, the general like nationalist drive of all Koreans for unification, etc., etc. Really, the only people who are invested in the continued separation of Korea in South Korea at the time was this ruling establishment that was directly put in power by the United States and, of course, the American puppet master. Much more importantly, a South Korean loss would be a international geopolitical mess that the United States would have to deal with. So they were very stern with saying, do not fuck around. Park disobeyed them once only, causing certain border clashes, but he was very quickly reined in by the Americans. So it's, again, unsurprising. Who are the people who pull the strings.
Asian Florida at that time, basically.
Exactly right, yeah. Regardless, in January of 1968, there was a very interesting episode of history, which honestly could be its own episode. Something called Unit 124 of the North Korean People's Army Special Forces Commandos attempted to assassinate Park, and they nearly succeeded, but sadly did not.
So here we should start with what exactly Unit 124 was. So 124 was a black ops unit formed specifically to assassinate President Park. The group consisted of 31 men, all officers handpicked from the Korean People's Army. These guys were the baddest asses around, and their mission was simple. Cross the DMZ, get to the Blue House, the president's official residence in Seoul, and kill Park Chung-hee. In preparation for the raid, the operatives of Unit 124 underwent 2 years of rigorous training, including 2 weeks of dry runs at a full-scale replica of the Blue House. So they wanted to go in very prepared here. Then on January 17th, 1968, Unit 124 successfully crossed through the DMZ without alerting the Republic of Korea Army or the U.S. 2nd Infantry Division. The team was officially behind enemy lines and made camp at the west bank of the Imjin River. On January 19th, the would-be assassins crossed the river and trekked through the countryside towards Seoul, managing to remain undetected, at least for a while. That afternoon, they encountered four locals of a nearby village, who quickly reported them to the police. Their cover blown, the team quickly threw on the uniforms of the local Korean 26th Infantry Division and split up, hoping to draw less attention in groups of two or three people. This worked, again, for a little while. Things were going as well as could be expected until around 10 p.m. on the night of January 21st, when some of the men were stopped at a checkpoint just 100 meters from the Blue House. They were so close, like that was that spitting distance. But the police chief questioned the soldiers, and he became suspicious of their answers. And when he drew his gun, some of the unit's operatives shot him, sparking a shootout and an immediate manhunt to find the rest of the assassins. This marked the end of the ill-fated Blue House mission. By January 29th, 29 of the 31 operatives of Unit 124 had been killed or committed suicide. One of the remaining two members provided information to the South Korean officials and defected. The other, Park Jae-kyung, was the only operative to make it back to the North, where he continued his military career. Today, at 90 years old, Park still serves his country and is a general in the Korean People's Army, the vice minister in the Ministry of People's Armed Forces, and a delegate of the 12th Supreme People's Assembly. In May of 1972, so a few years later, Kim Il-sung had a meeting in Seoul with the head of the Korean Central Intelligence Agency, and he expressed that the Blue House raid had not been his intention, claiming instead that it was, quote, entirely plotted by extreme leftists and did not reflect my intent or that of the party. So there you go. That's an interesting historical tidbit of one of the most well prepared for, I would say, assassination attempts of the era, which unfortunately was botched when some locals decided, hey, let's turn these weird guys in, and the rest is history.
Promote that police chief. That's all I'm fucking saying. Yeah, he's the enemy or whatever, but Jesus Christ, 100 meters in front of the place. They're like, whoo.
Yeah.
So, following some back and forth after these events, both Koreas came together to propose reunification talks after this. And they, of course, made some headway, as it, of course, happens each time they do have talks. Unsurprisingly, the U.S. immediately blocked these talks and drew a hard red line saying, this is not happening and you can't hold any more talks. The tentacle is always there to swipe at what doesn't interest American capital. As Park was entering into his second term, or finishing up his second term in the end of 1967, he amended the constitution to allow himself to run for a third term, which was up until then illegal. There were term limits. Fearing that he might lose power, he started doing some typical, you know, fascist government stuff. There was a particularly noted poet, Kim Chi-ha, who wrote a pretty benign poem. If you read it, it's not that, you know, inflammatory, you could say, about corruption in the country, and he was sentenced to death for it. The sentence wasn't carried out in the end for a variety of reasons, but he basically spent like 10 years in prison on death row for a poem. Jesus Christ. In 1971, he won the general, quote unquote, won the general election and immediately declared a state of emergency, saying, based on the dangerous realities of the international situation, whatever those were. I mean, I think at every point in history, there are dangerous realities of the international situation. In 1972, Park dissolved the legislature and suspended his own 1963 constitution in a self-coup, which is a thing that people do, I guess. He started rewriting his own constitution that he himself wrote many years prior. And in writing this constitution, he drew inspiration from Ferdinand Marcos, the far-right dictator in the Philippines, who orchestrated a similar coup just a few weeks prior. Again, trying to shake hands with the most reactionary people that he can find.
Collecting them like fucking Pokemon cards at this point.
Honestly, yeah. Of course, this new constitution, titled the Yushin Constitution, was in essence a legal dictatorship, as much as that can exist. He ruled by decree. The KCIA controlled the whole country with more than 40,000 regular employees. Jeez. And 1 million correspondents. So, you know, people talking shit about East Germany and whatnot. Of course, that conversation is nuanced, but you never hear about this. My God. And by the way, NSA, I'm not getting, like, do I, like, it's generally is fucking stupid that people even are still, anyways.
Alas.
Yes, alas. Striking workers, protesters, or even signatories of like petitions, petitions you fucking hand out on the street, face long prison sentences, torture, and even sometimes execution. The whole country was under constant surveillance. Of course, this is a typical symptom of a waning, you know, political power. In August of 1974, Park was delivering a speech when a Japanese-born North Korean sympathizer fired at him, but missed. This is a very interesting episode of history because his wife, Park's wife, who was sitting right beside him, was hit by a stray bullet amongst several other people, and she died later that day. Mm. Park's wife, as well as several people who were on the stage at the time, were shot and were laying on the stage bleeding out, and Park looked over to them and then continued his speech as his dying wife was being carried off the stage.
No way!
Yeah.
Canceled. Canceled. If for nothing else, then cancel him for that.
다시 한번 강조하면서 우리가 그동안 인정.
My God, if you look at the face of the guy, by the way, you can tell he's a cold motherfucker, but God damn, dude. The man who carried out the attempted assassination was hanged in a Seoul prison just a few months later. In 1975, in preparation for South Korea's bid to host the 1988 Olympic Games, he again ordered these bands of police and other units to quote-unquote cleanse the streets and expel beggars, vagrants, street vendors, and anybody who he thought gave the country a bad image abroad. Mm. These victims of a social cleansing campaign numbered in the tens of thousands of people. They were sent all en masse into camps. They were subjected to forced labor, torture, repeated rape, which is something that comes up over and over again. And he personally viewed this positively, saying that this is cleaning up the country.
Wow.
Over the next several years, summary execution, surveillance, failing economic development, censorship, all these things kind of began to culminate in a massive amount of unrest in the country, specifically in the form of student protests. And this came to the decisive moment in October of 1979, when students and workers, of course, many of them leftists that many American sources refused to recognize, many of these students and workers began organizing across the country. I believe Hyundai workers were the first ones to break, you know, the law on limitations on trade union activity. And that's kind of what spurred this entire movement. Attacks were launched by protesters at police stations. City offices of the ruling party were seized. Basically, a revolutionary moment was being built. Curfew was established. Martial law was declared. The military was mobilized. And then Park was assassinated by his own buddy and head of the KCIA.
There is a new government tonight in South Korea. Park Chung-hee, who ruled the country for more than 18 years, is dead. The new government announced that President Park was killed by a shot fired accidentally by the head of South Korea's Central Intelligence Agency at a dinner party Friday night in downtown Seoul. However, there are other reports that indicate the shooting may not have been accidental, and Park's chief bodyguard and four others were also killed.
This story is very interesting, I think. By the way, of course, everybody, I hope, is clapping. rest in piss, okay? but yeah, Park was assassinated in a very interesting and unclear turn of history. Essentially, in October of 1979, Park instructed the KCIA to prepare for one of his many numerous banquets, which were basically held on average 10 times per month.
Jeez.
Yeah, extravagant guy. The banquet that was being held was to be attended by Park himself, the director of the KCIA, and various other government officials, particularly in clandestine fields. So it was, again, like the real power behind the Mirage, I guess, not the Mirage, the facade. as well as, interestingly, two young women present during that day on that at that banquet, a at the time rising singer named Sim So-bong and a college student named Shin Jae-sun. Of course, they were most likely brought there as some kind of, I don't know, sexist eye candy appeal, yeah, and as well as entertainment, as is typical with this sort of nonsense. During the dinner, there were certain volatile political issues being discussed, demonstrations in Busan, the nature of opposition leaders, the protests, and the conversation got apparently very heated. Some were trying to steer the topic to, you know, small talk to kind of calm people down, but Park wouldn't have any of it. He rebuked the director of the KCIA for not being repressive enough in dealing with protesters. Some other people who were siding with K were suggesting that the demonstrators and those resisting the dictatorship should be mowed down with tanks. As the conversation was getting heated, one of the, again, members of the clandestine background power within South Korea at the time, entered into the meeting room with a semi-automatic Walther PPK pistol and opened fire, as, of course, the conversation was still ongoing. He shot several people in the arm and, of course, Park in the right chest. The gun then jammed as he was trying to kill other people in the room who were allied with Park, and... the guy left the room and then came back with a Smith & Wesson revolver and then got back to
fire.
Let
me get my better one.
Exactly right.
He went for style points at first with the sexy little PPK, yeah, and he's like, okay, I got to get the workhorse.
But yeah, but exactly the right. Beauty of it, kind of like the metaphor also during the Cold War, yeah, and the PPK, yeah, and then after that, the Smithy, the you know, the working. Okay, I'm not going to go there. Okay, please.
The execution was fairly brutal. One of Park's allies was shot in the abdomen before being able to speak to Park about what's going on or trying to create some sort of plan. And then he walked up to Park and then shot him in the head. Execution style is what the official report describes it as.
Is that different from Gangnam style?
So fucking stupid. So fucking stupid. Oh my god.
I love you so much.
Please continue.
The detectives that came, yes, in afterwards, they said, and they looked at the body and they were like, a professional must have done it. And in the background, through the hallway, you're hearing, do Gangnam style, and the door slams open. And he comes back with two Smithies.
You just hear bullets.
Yeah.
But yeah. Of course, the bodyguards in the adjacent room started hearing the commotion and
style.
Went to... exactly right. They started dancing brutally. No, they walked in. Of course, some of them tried to surrender. Some of them tried to fight back. All of them were killed.
Wow.
Several other people in the room were executed, most of them being either Park's bodyguards or related allies. But also the presidential chauffeur who was just chilling in the car outside was executed. I don't know why. They just walked up and shot him, which I think, like, that's the only guy in that room or in that setting that didn't deserve it.
Yeah.
This dude was just doing a job. The aftermath of this was very interesting. There was scrambling in the government. The KCIA was quickly trying to consolidate power. Different generals within the military were trying to mobilize their forces. Nobody knew exactly what was happening. And finally, particular general did manage to essentially win the bid to investigate into the assassination, and as a result, while the investigation was ongoing, managed to consolidate all like internal security and military power underneath him, and eventually launched a new coup. But before this, basically, all of these events happened on the 26th of October 1979, which is around a week after the student protest had ended. This particular execution resulted in the arrest by soldiers under South Korea's Army Chief of Staff. The people who carried out the assassination were arrested. They were tortured and then later executed, despite the fact that they essentially handed power to the next sequence of dictators. Mm. As is typical in these kinds of governments, you don't want anybody who knows anything left. So after his execution, he was given a state funeral with full rights. And the general who consolidated power, Chun Doo-hwan, basically replaced him as a military dictator into the late 80s. All of this power struggle nonsense finally ended after the June Democratic Struggle, which was a movement of course, leftist students, trade unionists, and workers who fought for the right to unionize, to demonstrate, and of course for a form of democratic representation that didn't exist in Korea at the time. Interestingly, they were seeing an average of 44 strikes a day during this period.
Wow.
which is goddamn good on them. Yeah. That Americans fucking take heed. Goddamn. Yeah. Or not take heed. Like, take, get some inspiration. Jesus Christ. But yeah, anyways. At prior and slightly after this time, around his execution, Park started realizing that not only is his power waning, but the general like enthusiasm for supporting reactionary anti-communist governments was dying a little bit in the West. The United States was still, of course, all gung-ho about it, but he was seeing the writing on the wall, and decided to start a homegrown nuclear weapons program. And they apparently, according to their estimations, he would have been ready by 1983 with nuclear weapons. But of course, this was never... He was assassinated in 1979, so this never came to pass. The particular development of Korea after this is, I think, an episode of its own, so we won't go into it. But it did eventually transition to what could be considered a liberal democracy. But... of course, as is with all bourgeois democracies, there is a incredible overrepresentation of this same comprador and corporatist class that existed in Korea during this dictatorship period. And they're still the ones who rule kind of behind the shadows. They're the ones who have all the money. They're the ones who support all these politicians. They're the ones who support political campaigning. And they essentially control almost every facet of Korean life. I think it's something like 5 companies, really. And Samsung is the biggest one. Park himself had several kids, and his daughter would eventually enter into politics and become president in 2013. Of course, very normal in a so-called democratic nation that the daughter of the former dictator becomes president. But she was impeached, basically, in 2017 on accounts of, and I shit you not, abuse of power and coercion charges, which is a complicated story of its own. She apparently had some, like, I don't know, a Rasputin situation going on with a guy who would, like, divinate from the stars and tell her what to do.
Hell yeah.
Some cult leader of some kind, but yeah.
Vibes-based leadership. I love it.
Exactly right. I think this is a fairly good point to just put a full stop on the story before we go on too much. But one thing that has kind of been omitted, and I think we'll probably do an episode of its own on this topic if people are interested, is the concept of the miracle on the Han River, which is the economic so-called miracle of South Korea, development of South Korean industry, and how exactly they managed to develop along basically state ownership, but also corporatist lines through economic planning. Of course, this is the same process that Japan went through, and is kind of quote-unquote characteristic of certain Asian economies, the quote-unquote tiger economies. I'm saying quote unquote because there's a lot of racism associated with these things. Like, oh, the they're shrewd but very efficient, the Asiatics.
These mysterious, yeah.
Exactly right. But yeah, there are, of course, very specific and unique differences amongst all of them, and there are certain material conditions that gave rise to these developments, obviously. I will leave only one reading recommendation here because you guys have been flooded by my previous ones. This is one, and this is generally the only book you ever need to read. Of course, you should always read more, but this is the best book in my personal experience. It's called Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, The Story of Korea's Struggle for Freedom by Stefan Goans. Goans is a fantastic writer, and he's written many books, and his blog is also fantastic. But this particular book is the best introduction into what happened in Korea, essentially the division, the background politics, and the aftermath. And it's the perfect place to start. Of course, there's plenty of reading recommendations you can get within this book if you're interested further, but this is the, you know, like point zero you should start at.
One other recommendation from me, friends of the podcast, the Blowback Boys, have an entire season on the Korean War. It's very, very good. Give that a listen. It's a great time, and you'll learn a lot.
And for one sadly defunct now podcast, but they were fantastic when they were working, is Pearls of the Round Table episode 11, titled The Rich History of the DPRK, which is a very, very good episode that I highly recommend. They, of course, include some reading recommendations in their show notes as well, so I highly recommend that you you read it. If you're interested in particularly the DPRK, then there's an old book titled Socialist Korea, A Case Study in the Strategy of Economic Development, which is very, very interesting because it is a stat-filled book to my recommendation. It's been fucking years since I've looked into it. It's like 600 pages of very, very detailed look into the development of Korea from a socialist lens. I hope that everybody enjoyed this episode. Of course, we're trying to make it slightly more cinematic for these historical types. Let us know if you enjoy it. Please do check out the Patreon. We have many interesting perks and incentives for people to join. We have the Habibi tier, particularly, which allows people to join us in very interesting discussions that we have monthly. We have, of course, the Discord and a bunch of other interesting things, such as bonus episodes, which there's going to be more of. I'm not going to say exactly what, but there's things coming down the line that you won't want to miss. Likewise, please do check out the merch and, of course, our news show, that's on YouTube, titled First Thought, very creatively. With all that being said, this has been the program. I'm Hakim.
I'm JT.
I'm Igopnik. And Open Gangnam Style.